Chariot Solutions TechCast episode number 71, Brian Fox of Sonotype on Nexus 2. The TechCast is produced by Chariot Solutions Education Services. If you need training or mentoring in Java, Scala, Spring, Hibernate, or Rails, we can get you up to speed. At our classrooms, on-site, or online, reach us at chariotsolutions.com/education. Brian Fox is a longtime open source contributor, having worked on Maven 2 and overseeing the development of Maven 3. He is the VP of Engineering at Sonotype and currently leads the Nexus repository project. The team has just released version 2.0, which includes support for the growing .NET open source community and the NuGet library manager. We discuss the evolution of Maven in repository management, the Nexus repository manager, and key features in 2.0, such as the new smart proxy and advent of Sonotype's new repository license intelligence and health awareness. Brian Fox, welcome to the Chariot TechCast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, people may know you from seeing you on the Apache Maven projects and some of the documentation, on seeing various entries and forums and blogs and such. Just tell us who you are in general and how you are associated with these projects.
Yeah, okay. So I've been doing software development for somewhere around 15 years now, I guess. I got involved in the Maven project early on in the 2.0 alphas time frame and started writing plugins and submitting bug fixes and things like that. I've been a committer on the Apache Maven project, since early 2006, and wrote a couple of the more popular plugins, like the Maven dependency plugin, the Maven enforcer plugin. And then I moved in more into doing some of the core fixes around the artifact resolution, some of it driven by bugs I uncovered in the dependency plugin. Mm-hmm. And then I became a PMC member for the Maven project in 2007. So the PMC is the body that oversees the direction of the project and makes it official. They're the eyes and the ears of the project at Apache. I did a lot of work on some of the 2.0, 7, 8, 9, 10 releases back then, between 2007, 2009, I guess. And then in 2009, Jason stepped down as the PMC chair. So I stepped up and took that. I was the PMC chair for 2 years up until the summer, last summer. So now I'm just on the PMC and still a committer.
And, Maven has had quite a long past in history, I suppose. I guess it started, about 2003, 2004. It was kind of written to make builds easier for one of the Maven projects, or one of the Apache projects, right?
Yeah, it a little bit predates my involvement, but the history, as I understand it, is it came out of the Avalon project. Mm-hmm. An attempt by Jason there to sort of bring some order to the build system that was growing, kind of hairy. And Maven 1, came out somewhere in that time frame, and very quickly after, work started on a Maven 2, sort of in parallel to the Maven 1. So Maven 1 and Maven 2, they share a name and some concepts, but hardly any code in common between the two. They're almost separate projects.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I became involved right around the time when 2.0 was getting alphas. So I don't have a lot of experience with Maven 1.
But one of the things that grew up in parallel to that was the whole, concept of, as you mentioned, the dependencies. And, Maven's whole, one of the biggest points of Maven, besides the convention of the build, is the convention of how to get things out and bring them to you, right? So the whole concept of not checking in jars to a source control system.
Right. I think that was one of the unique things that Maven brought to the table, and may, in fact, over the long tail, be the legacy from Maven, years down the road, is that, it introduced the concept of, at least to the Java land, of having binary reusability and not rebuilding the world as everybody was used to doing. So that was certainly one aspect of it. The other aspect was making things more of a declarative model, and especially around the dependencies, so that you can start to get a deeper understanding of transitive dependencies and dependency management, was sort of all unique at the time.
Right. And, Commons Lang 3 is really this particular jar with this version and stamp and this build, for example.
That's right. Yeah, everything in Maven has a unique coordinate system, so everything is well-defined. And you know, it, they have a canonical name usually, so that you, when things are trying to resolve matches against two different projects or conflicts, we can be sure that we're talking about the same artifact. You know, prior to that, the common pattern was for people to take all their jars and check them into a lib folder, and then just on the class path say, you know, include star.jar, and then, you know, you'd go to upgrade a version, and nobody knew why these things were in there, and you had no way of knowing conflicts, and so you ended up bundling up, you know, megabytes, dozens of megabytes of extra jars that probably didn't even need to be there because nobody really had any way of figuring it out.
So, okay, so we have this whole concept of the repositories. Maven Central Repository was established for 1 and 2, I guess. Originally, that was just a file directory system, right? There wasn't really much more than that and some XML metadata?
Yeah, you know, it started because of the whole the desire to have canonical sets of coordinate systems. The best way to do that is to start collecting these artifacts in their coordinate systems and making them available to everybody so that people aren't making up their own coordinates for the same jars. And yeah, that started probably, you know, 2001, 2002 timeframe, very early on in the Maven 1 aspect. And it moved around a few times in its hosting, but it's been hosted by Jason and later Sonatype now for probably 6 or 7 years, I want to say.
I'm guessing that it's a rather torrid amount of bandwidth that you take up by hosting these things.
Yeah, that's an understatement. for the better part of my time at Sonatype here for the last 5 years, I was primarily responsible, or the person who was primarily responsible for Central and the bandwidth and all of that stuff. And it we were just talking today about having to increase the disk size again on Central. Because we just pulled in a lot of the Scala tools artifacts en masse when the Scala tools kind of shut down, and we took it over and moved it into our public hosting that we have. And I think we added another 60 gigs or something like that to Central. So it jumps. Yeah, I mean, I remember back when Central was 60 gigs and I had a copy of it on my laptop. Now we're approaching half a terabyte. And we're adding new projects, you know, 50 to 60 individual projects every single day. So it's a disk eater as well as a bandwidth eater.
And probably process too. Like, what does it take to get a released artifact into the Maven Central repository?
Yeah, that's actually an excellent question. There's several well-known paths through the forges. Typically, artifacts have to come through forges because, you know, they're usually running Nexus. In fact, all of the forges are running Nexus, and they use the staging functionality to do validation of the artifacts so that they meet the minimum criteria for Central. You know, things like they have a valid signature, the checksums are correct, they're in the right coordinate system, the POM has minimum things in it like the license and all of that stuff defined. And so, you know, the big forges are like Apache and JBoss and Java.net and CodeHaas. And then we have one that we provide for independent projects. And that one has over 3,000 independent projects in it right now.
Wow. What is that called? Is there a specific name for that one?
We call it OSS. We have a couple names for it. We call it OSSRH, but the URL is oss.sonatype.org.
Okay, right. I got you. And I see now that's got the Nexus instance sitting here for all the various projects. That's great. Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, we went from this, obviously we've got Central, and for public projects and open source projects where you want to contribute to the outside world and make a difference in the open source world, that's certainly an angle. But if you're a commercial developer and you've got commercial software, or you've got software internally you don't need to share, you need to really start thinking about your own private repo, right? And so what's the story there for developers who need to do that?
Yeah, it's sort of, it's definitely interesting. I kind of had a light bulb moment even yesterday, because with the introduction of the NuGet support in Nexus and therefore, you know, really starting to actively engage the .NET community, it sort of refreshed my memory about how all of this stuff evolved over time, because, you know, it's taken us sort of 5 years, 6 years to really elaborate on the repository management side as people, you know, got mature around how they were Actium. It's like we all grew up together and figured out what we wanted to do, and then we're starting to recover that same ground again with .NET. So it's pretty exciting. But one of the primary things inside a company when you're sharing artifacts or when you're using Maven and you're trying to do this binary reusability, the first thing is you need a place to put them. And so, you know, early on, people were doing this with WebDAV, SCP, flat file systems, you know, just mapped folders and things like that. And that quickly became, you know, not really tenable because, especially with Maven and snapshots, you would tend to be creating tons of snapshots that eat up disk like nobody's business. And then you have to go and reclaim that. And then every once in a while, you get a glitch where somebody overwrites a file or the metadata gets corrupted and you have to fix it by hand. So that was sort of one of the reasons for repository managers were something that understood these files better than just the file system. And it could put some logic on top of them saying, you can't overwrite these. This is how the metadata is rebuilt, indexing. And then the other desire was around bandwidth aggregation and that type of thing. So, you know, as repositories started popping up online, every single developer, when they run a build, would be going off to these repos and fetching the same sets of artifacts from the internet. So obviously there's a bandwidth problem, but more importantly, a time problem where it just wastes everybody's time as they download these things over and over. So you take those two things together, and that's sort of the definition of what the early repository managers were all about. It's really about proxying the outside repositories, providing a sane place for you to host your internal ones, and then be able to aggregate those together into a single view that all the developers could pull from. So that's sort of like adoption level one, if you want to think of it that way.
Right.
And as soon as that started to happen, people really looked at that and said, well, wait a minute, now that we've got all of our developers pulling from a central place, now we can really put some controls down around what's actually going on. And initially, it was simply around which repositories am I allowed to pull from? So, you know, if somebody needs something from some new random repository that nobody's heard of, if they're going through a Nexus repo, an administrator would have to go and add that to the system. So there would be some implicit checks to make sure that this is a valid thing that is approved for usage. Later on, the next level from that was people weren't just interested in vetting whole repositories or whole external proxies. They were more interested in being able to lay down fine-grained controls over specific artifacts. So you can't use this set, you know, maybe our corporate standard is to use logback but not log4j, that kind of thing, right? Or don't use this version of log4j because it's known to be broken or something. So, you know, it sort of evolved as there was this initial desire for time and cost savings to pull it together. But once we had that together, we sort of evolved on the things we could do. More recently, it's sort of grown into sort of governance and risk and compliance types of things around security and license obligations, and being able to really have fine-grained control over artifacts for reasons other than the artifact itself is just known to be buggy, but maybe it has a bad license, or simply blocking things, whole categories of licenses and stuff like that. So that's kind of the repository management story over the last 5 years, sort of how it evolved.
Let's talk a little about the Nexus engine. So if you're going to set up a repository manager, you're going to set up Nexus. What are you really setting up at this point? You know, what is Nexus? How is it run?
So Nexus is basically a J2 EE web app type of application. We provide it with an embedded Jetty instance, so you can start it up just like any other service. But underneath the hood, it's really what you would more expect of a web application in a deployment mode. But what it's really doing is it's exposing HTTP or SSL ports that you can put and get artifacts from, and then underneath the hood, it's storing things in the native layout on disk.
And so you can run it on any web server you want to, really. You just basically need to have the disk space and the place where you're going to put the OSS directories and such. You've got basically an open source model, and then you've got some commercial plugins on top of that. What do people get when they just download it for open source? Are they limited in any way from using it, or are they able to just kind of use it minus a few features?
Nope, people don't refer to this term anymore as much as they did a few years ago, but it's more of an open core type of model where the Nexus OSS version is really the core functionality of Nexus, and then the professional versions add onto that core with additional plugins and features. So the OSS version isn't really limited in any way. It's just you don't have the extended functionality in that we've added to the pro version. But out of the box, you still get the ability to do the proxying, the aggregation, and all of that sophisticated routing and security and all of that core functionality. You know, it's not limited in any way in that OSS version.
Right. So, yeah, I was struck by that, too. You download it, you set it up, and it doesn't take much time at all. You pretty much just run it, and you've got your repository manager with basic accounts and everything set up. It was very easy to use. How about managing it, backing it up, that kind of thing? What do you have to know about in terms of your administrative skills to deal with a repository engine? What are the important things to keep in mind if you're going to set something like this up?
Yeah, so that's something that we've paid a lot of attention to, because even in big shops with big central services organizations, it's still nice for development teams to be able to get the tools they need and not get in the way of, you know, of having to jump through a lot of hoops. And so we've made sure that Nexus can be pretty easily managed by somebody that you know, has some basic understanding of servers and things like this. But specifically, Nexus stores its stuff as flat files in the native repository layout. So if you're using a Maven 2 layout, that's how we store it on disk. So it's any tools that understand Maven can understand the storage location of Nexus. And that's pretty important, because it means that it's easy to move from one server to another. It also means backups are very easy, because the way Maven works, it's always introducing new files and hardly ever changing old files. So incremental file backups are a piece of cake to achieve using standard file backup types of tools. You don't have to be a database administrator to achieve the right performance and redundancy and backup with Nexus. And that's something we've always strived to make sure was possible.
Now, also, you don't just have to use Maven to check things into Nexus, right? I mean, I know that there's a library. When you said you refactored Maven 3, you refactored out dependency management, that's the Ether library, right?
That's right. Okay. So Nexus is basically operating on HTTP, so it gets and puts. So Nexus doesn't really care what is actually doing the put. And there is built-in support for Maven repositories in all of the popular build tools. So, you know, Ivy support, Ivy understands Maven 2 repositories. So the, you know, Gradle uses Ivy under the hood. I believe Builder does as well. So a lot of those tools, the Scala build tool on the Scala side, I think also uses some of the Ivy stuff. So, you know, Nexus doesn't really care, and it's compatible with all of those. What's important is really the adherence to the Maven 2 standard, and then all of the tools interoperate that way.
Now, the first time I ever heard of Nexus being used, well, actually, I had read about Nexus, or more Maven, being used to build, you know, .NET projects and C++ projects. I actually had a student in one of my classes who was building RPMs with native C code using Maven. I thought that would be an interesting build to look at. But it's being done, right? So, but there's a big jump between that and then also hosting other types of platforms, right? Because I'm guessing NuGet, which that's what a package manager essentially for .NET is a bit different, correct, in terms of the way that they look at things, or are they looking at them roughly the same way?
Yeah, NuGet strikes me it's a little bit Maven-like because it's related to the build environment, but it also feels to me a little bit, you know, like a Linux package manager-like, where it also is able to download and install things. So it's somewhere in between. But their layout underneath the hood is very different. And, you know, Nexus supports different layouts. Out of the box, it comes with Maven 1, Maven 2, P2, OBR, which is a different version of OSGI standards, and now NuGet. And I'm probably forgetting a couple. You know, there's some old Eclipse update site, you know, the Eclipse 3.5 or 3.4, whatever it was, the older style is also supported. And in most cases, Nexus is able to translate from one standard to another. So if you were to deploy a NuGet gallery package with the right metadata in it into a Maven 2 repository, because you were for whatever reason you're using Maven to build it, for example, Nexus would detect that and then be able to expose that as a gallery feed. Same thing with OBR and P2, right? So it's able to do the translation between these two different worlds.
So here's a complete side note, and it's more of a, you know, there's that community out there that doesn't like Java at all, and they're called Rubyists.
Right.
I'm teasing because some of them put things on, you know, JRuby. Right. You've got the whole gem system there. Are there plans for you to support your own gem servers, or are there plugins for Nexus to do that?
You know, it's something that we've experimented over the years with, even working with some of the JRuby guys at various times. And I think we even have some experimental gems plugins out there. Mostly focused around making the things in Maven Central accessible to JRuby applications. Yeah, it's not something that's rolled into the product today, but it is something that we've looked at, and they've done some changes on their side, I think, in the way they look at the metadata and that type of stuff. But it hasn't been a popular request to date from corporations. It's more to support the open source community at this point.
Right. And that's true, because a lot of the Ruby stuff now, I know Ruby's moving into the enterprise, and, you know, certainly people are doing that more. I think that's going to grow up over time more, I would think. But are there any other areas that you're looking at extending Nexus to provide?
Another common format is RPM people want to use. So once people start getting Nexus in and it sort of becomes the hub of all binary distribution inside of an organization, they start to look at it and hook up provisioning services to it and things like that. So especially if your build system is in fact producing RPMs, which is pretty common, then people want to be able to just directly expose that so then they can provision it right out to their servers. But Nexus has a pretty robust plugin model. So we have customers who have defined their own repository layout types to do all kinds of stuff, virtual images for machines, you know, ESX, VMware ESX types of things, videos, that kind of thing, all distribution. So it's really interesting to see how it grows from being just a place to share artifacts like in the early days to a central place for pushing all binaries back and forth between many different types of systems.
And I'm sure it's nothing near what you were thinking of when you were starting working on Nexus that it would end up being used that way.
The irony is not, that's not exactly true. When Thomas, one of the original authors of Proximity, that later became Nexus, I think one of his main reasons for creating it in the day was that he had an unstable internet connection where he lived in Hungary, and he had a bunch of Linux machines running internally, and he was having trouble updating them all the time. Because they were always downloading the same artifacts from the same sets of repositories over and over again. I mean, it's a very similar story, right, that I described to Maven. And so very early on, he was using the proxying aggregation capability for exactly those purposes.
Oh, that's funny.
But that was more of something that, I guess us geeks were messing around with. It really didn't catch on until more recently.
Right.
So it's sort of come full circle.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Right, exactly. Yep.
And then the itch got bigger.
Yeah, that's right.
Interesting, yeah. All right, so let's talk a little bit then about Nexus versus Nexus Pro. What are some of the features that you get with Nexus Pro?
So Nexus Pro introduces the ability to stage artifacts and hold them, sort of quarantine them into separate repositories, and then do validation against them, run rules, do your IT testing, maybe some integration with other components, and then ultimately promote them out to, the public repositories that the rest of your development organization might have. So it gives you the ability to have a do-over if a release gets botched or whatnot. That's one of the more popular features. In fact, we sort of built that up. The initial version of Pro, that was one of the main features, and it sort of evolved over the best practices that we were using in the open source communities, because typically the release manager would post a release and then the rest of the community would have to vote on it. And those things would be sitting off on their personal storage location and, their home folder. And then somebody would have to merge those things in. So the patterns for that in the quarantining sort of grew up with Maven and with the rest of the open source communities, and we sort of codified it in Nexus to make it possible to do without manual intervention. So that's a huge feature, and all of the forges use that, like I said, to promote their artifacts and do their voting and then get things ultimately into central. We also have what we call procurement support, which you can think a little bit like a firewall on top of the inbound artifacts, but with pluggable rules, so you can write rules that basically say, you know, if the signature is not valid or whitelist, blacklist, these types of artifacts. So it's more about inbound artifact control, where staging is about outbound artifact control. And then we have enterprise LDAP support that lets you have multiple LDAP servers, failover, multiple root nodes, you know, all the types of things you see in large enterprises, you know, where the LDAP directories get a little bit hairy through acquisitions and things like that. So there's a lot of support for that. You know, configuration backup. There's a lot of other features, but the staging, procurement are two big ones. There's the NuGet support that's new in 2.0. So that's a pretty popular feature. We were surprised at how popular that was, to be honest, early days. I think when I did a webinar on it back in October, something like half of the questions we had were around the .NET support, which if I had a bet before that, I would have bet the opposite. So, you know, it was ironic. And then more recently, we've introduced the ability to see the Insight data service as a repository health check inside of Nexus Professional. So Insight is a sort of a separate product line that we have that provides information on security vulnerabilities and licenses and, you know, open source licenses, obligations, all that type of stuff. So what we've done in Pro 2.0 is we've allowed you to scan your repository and through the analysis we bring back and we show you which artifacts have known security vulnerabilities, which artifacts have licenses based on our analysis, which sometimes is not what the license has been declared to be. Right, so it may in fact include something GPL when in fact it's supposed to be ASL, and that can be surprising to people. And so we've integrated that in Pro 2.0 so that you can see what's going on and start to build a cleaner repository for your applications.
But if you want to get started with Nexus, you can download the free version. You can use it for pretty much most every development process. It fits in whether you do things manually through scripts or want to move up to the higher level, but there's no major upgrade path besides installing a few plugins and adding a license, right, to make it go to Pro?
That's right. The upgrade from OSS to Pro is the same as you would go through to upgrade from one version to the next. You basically unpack the new distribution. They share the same layout in the data storage. Like I said, underneath the hood, they're using the standard, you know, layouts, Maven 2, OSGI, whatever. And so if you want to upgrade, you just unpack the Pro next to the OSS, and then it will upgrade the data store, and you're off and running.
Okay. Well, then, and I guess in wrapping up here a little bit, so there's material available online. You've got all your management books and such on Maven. You've got a Nexus book on.
Yes, yeah, you could find all of it from sonatype.com.
Right, the support menu on the top, and under books, it looks like that's where it is.
That's right.
And so beyond that, there's training available, right? We were talking about, we do Maven training here at Chariot. We were talking about doing Nexus training in the future, but you guys also have online training available now, right?
That's right, yeah, that's another thing that's been around with Sonatype since the early days. I was one of the original trainers with Jason. In fact, that was the first thing I did when I started with Jason full time, was fly to Switzerland to do 2 weeks of Maven training. It was sort of trial by fire.
Right.
So I'm glad that we have the online training and that we have other trainers that are doing that for us.
Yeah.
It can be quite draining.
Yep.
But yeah, we've got a number of classes online. There's sort of the introductory, then there's the more advanced, and we have some Nexus classes now too.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you're in the Philly area, we certainly do the training here. If you're looking for training, you know, online, certainly go to sonatype.com and check out their online training. And there's other places around the world that will support that as well. So, great. Brian, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and talking about Nexus with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Brian for speaking to us today on the TechCast. You can find his blog entries for Sonatype at sonatype.com/people/author/Brian, or just Google it. Nexus is available at nexus.sonatype.org. You can also find Brian on Twitter at Brian_Fox. For information about Chariot Solutions, our consulting and education services, head over to our website at chariotsolutions.com. There you'll find a list of our upcoming events, training, and information about the consulting practice. Our podcast themes are free themes number 3 and 4 from podcastthemes.com. We'll take any and all feedback, including voice comments. Send us links at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com or hit us up on Twitter at @techcast. For the show, I'm Ken Rimple.